First of all, I want to say what a pleasure it's been to be with you, to rehearse, to talk, and to worship together with great sacred music. Also, I want to thank Horst and Paul for their excellent musical leadership. It's been a pleasure to be with them as well. And Janet, who has done such an enormous amount of work to organize this
Yay,
workshop.
Thank you, Janet.
So, one other thing, and that is, if you're not a member of the Church Music Association of America, I would suggest that you consider joining. You'll get four issues of Sacred Music, which is filled with good stuff, and which gives you some leadership in the direction of sacred music and in the direction of the music that we've been doing at this workshop. And also, it gives you a discount on other Church Music Association activities, the colloquium in the summer, as well as chant intensives like this. Think about coming to the colloquium this summer at Chicago. This is a mini colloquium, but that is a maxi colloquium. There are about 200 people there, and the possibilities of doing many wonderful things are there. The campus at Loyola University on the lakefront is beautiful. The chapel is beautiful. The chapel faces the lake. You come out of the front door of the chapel, and there's the lake. You have to watch out you don't step into the lake. So I would encourage you to do that. Likewise, to look at the table back there and see that there are a number of copies of Sacred Music, which you can take if you like. If you have not subscribed to them, you can take your copies, and then you can get hooked on it, and then you'll have to subscribe. Likewise, there are a couple of copies of my own book left there on the table, and a couple of you have asked, where can I read more about what you talked about today? And one of the places is in that book, The Musical Shape of the Liturgy. But also, I spend a fair amount of effort in writing an editorial for Sacred Music each issue. And I think there's some nice things in there. Some of them are nicer than others, but there are some nice things in there. So what I want to talk about today is silence and the beauty and sacredness of the liturgy. I mentioned, first of all, the book of Cardinal Robert Serra, The Power of Silence Against the Dictatorship of Noise. Cardinal Serra was born in a hut in Guinea, and his parents were converts. They sent him to a school taught by French missionaries. The missionaries identified a bright young student and sent him to the seminary. He was sent then to France for further study, and when John Paul II visited Guinea, he was then appointed Archbishop of Guinea at a very young age. John Paul noticed him and called him to the Vatican. And for some time he was head of the group that worked on the appointment of bishops for non-European countries. Very recently, he was appointed to the Commission on the Sacred Liturgy. At the Sacra Liturgia Conference in New York a year and a half ago, He sent a letter saying, I've been appointed as prefect of this congregation and on liturgy, and I asked the Pope, what do you want me to do? And the Pope's answer was, continue the work of Benedict. So that is very encouraging. One has seen some discouraging things as well, but one always wants to keep a positive attitude and hope, and realize that the prefect of the congregation on the sacred liturgy and the discipline of the sacraments is a man of considerable weight and spirituality. His book, God or Nothing, is an autobiography, and it narrates his progress, and it narrates his commitment to worship. One of the really tremendous things that one sees in that book is that when he was an archbishop, he would go on retreat for 3 days, fasting completely and praying. He said that was the only thing that could keep him being an archbishop. His book on silence, then, is, I would say, I haven't read for a long time a book that has been more effective for me, that has affected me more. An extraordinary a book that speaks about the role of silence in the cultivation of the presence of God and in the spirituality that is necessary these days. So I'm going to talk about silence first. Silence is a premise of music. Music arises from silence, and it returns to silence. And when it does not arise from silence or return to silence, it doesn't quite make it. The liturgy is filled with elements of silence that are significant. Recall the pause in the middle of the psalm verse. It's not very easy to maintain that, in fact, because of the dictatorship of noise. That is to say, we are so accustomed to having our ears filled all the time with something. The radio is on. I know people who leave their televisions on all the time. I don't know if they turn it off when they go to sleep. But they don't watch it. This is noise. And the fact is, that kind of noise is a distraction from introspection, from reflection, from prayer, from the cultivation of the sense of the presence of God. And if you don't, in doing sacred music, if you're not cognizant in one way or another of the presence of God, what on earth are you doing? So, the liturgy. There's a wonderful thing about the divine office. Remember that at the beginning of the divine office, you always say, Deus in agitorium meum intende. O God, come to my assistance. O Lord, make haste to help me. John Cassian, one of the great founders of Western monasticism, recounts that this was very often a means of praying always. The monks were recommended to continue to say, O God, come to my assistance. O Lord, make haste to help me. O God, come to my assistance. O Lord, make haste to help me, etc. Or there's the Jesus prayer. It's the same idea. What is wonderful about that is, once you realize what the history of that is, you see that the beginning of every divine office, except for Matins, is a link with praying always. That is to say, you are saying, O God, quietly to yourself, O God, come to my assistance, O Lord, make haste. Then you say it aloud as a formal beginning of the sung worship. There is the silence of the canon of the Mass in the old rite. In my diocese, priests are told to proclaim the gospel and the canon of the Mass. I can't think of two more different things that should not each be spoken of as a matter of proclamation. The gospel, the canon of the Mass is not proclaimed to the people. You read the text, and it is a prayer addressed to the Father. And the fact is that the silence, and every day it's the same text. And priests find themselves in need of varying the way they say the text, even the words of consecration. I have noticed how many different ways they say the words of consecration. This is my body. This is my body. This is my body which will be given up for you. I've heard every possible word emphasized, and none of them means anything, because it is the words of the Lord himself, and it's the words which consecrate the sacrament. And it needs to be said in a very sacred way. That's why the singing of the canon is a great respite from the need of the priest to engage the congregation by speaking the canon of the Mass. This is a terrible mistake. And so when we have the silence of the canon in the old rite, that is a point of repose and a point of reflection. You can read the text of the canon along with the priest, or remember it, or whatever, but you can also pray the parts of the canon in your own words and make meditation upon what is taking place. And all of that is, in fact, to become more cognizant of the presence of Christ in the sacrament. So silence has an important role in that. But also silence is represents an attitude towards prayer. In the divine office, when it's said in the monastery, after compline, there is great silence. That is to say, at least in the strict monasteries, they sing compline, and then they are strictly enjoined that they may not speak until the beginning of Matins. And, surprisingly, Matins begins with the prayer not, O Lord, come to my assistance, but, O Lord, open thou my lips, and my mouth shall show forth thy praise. And so, in the strictest monasteries, absolutely no talk. Even to the extent that if there is an emergency, you have to say, O Lord, open thou my lips first before you say anything else. So, O Lord, open thou my lips, fire! uh, One can, in fact, do what was very often done, particularly in the 18th century in France, sort of naturalistic explanations for things in the liturgy. There is a naturalistic explanation for such great silence. When you have men sleeping in a dormitory, the temptation to talk overnight is probably great. I can remember as a child when we would go out to have a sleeping party. We'd never get to sleep. So that there may well have been a necessity to make a strict enjoinment of against any speaking. But it also has a much more important spiritual significance, and that is, in silence, you then open yourself up to the presence of God. Out there, but also in here. And when you have a sense of recollection and equanimity that's created by keeping silence, you can hear the words of God and you can reflect upon his presence. Silence overnight has another interesting aspect, and that is, spiritual directors often recommend that if you're going to make a meditation the first thing in the morning, you read the text for the meditation just before you go to bed. That means you've put that text at the top of the hopper of what goes in to your brain while you sleep. And the fact is, sleep is a relatively active process, at least certain times in the night. It's a time when the activity of the day is reconciled with long-term memory. And I have found that if, for instance, I'm going to bed at 11 o'clock, and then all of a sudden I say, uh-oh, I'm supposed to give a lecture tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And if I stay up and make that lecture, I might fall asleep during the lecture. And so I sit down and make a very quick, it has to be a subject that you already know, but I make a quick outline and then go to sleep. When I wake up, the lecture's ready. It has been sorted, and I'm there somehow, and it works. So that's important. And so you can put spiritual thoughts at the top of your consciousness before you sleep. And before sleep, just as with the monks, you can put the presence of God in your consciousness as you go to sleep. And then you may have something important to think of in the morning. So then, what about the liturgy and silence? First of all, the liturgy and beauty, and the liturgy and the sacred. In the 19th century, Richard Wagner proposed a Gesamtkunstwerk. That is to say, his idea was that his kind of opera would be a composite usage of all of the arts. And his biggest creation runs some 20 hours, the Ring of the Nibelungen. I don't think he probably ever realized that a much greater Gesamtkunstwerk was the Catholic liturgy. The traditional liturgy was a composite of all of the arts. Just think of how significant every one of the arts can be in the liturgy. The Psalms are poetry, and yet they are composites of the propers of the Mass. One thinks of the composition of the Psalms of the propers of the Mass in their origins. It seems pretty clear that it wasn't that somebody said, okay, here is your text, now you write a melody for it. It was that the piece was conceived by thinking of what's an appropriate psalm and how is it appropriately sung by the same Schola Cantorum in Rome. And so the Psalms then form a basis for the artistic shape of the liturgy. But there is also the architecture. Just think about how important the architecture is. If you go into a modern church that looks disorderly, you're not oriented. The whole point of the architecture of a church is to orient you. And that's why there is a cultivation of saying Mass ad orientem. You're facing the same direction as the priest and the people are facing the same direction. And that direction is not the wall. That direction is transcendent. That direction is both priest and people are facing God. And this is the best way to be oriented in the divine liturgy. But every element of a good piece of ecclesiastical architecture contrives to support that orientation. The ceilings and the construction leading up to the ceilings suggest the heavens. In England, you have so very often the central tower right above, just before the altar, is a big tower that's open and with windows, and very often the window has in it an elaborate geometric design. That geometric design represents the cosmos. That geometric design represents heaven. You look up into that tower and it suggests that it just goes on up to heaven. So the parts of the architecture have a degree of sacredness. The altar is the most sacred place, but the side altars are also sacred places. If there's a communion rail, it demarks the sanctuary as a more sacred place. And I've done some reflection on the architecture of medieval England, and I've read anthropologists who talk about the sacred. Their notion is there is the sacred and then there's the profane. Either it's sacred or it's secular. This doesn't work for medieval culture. There are degrees of sacred. The center of the church is the most sacred place. But even the portal, the back door, is a sacred point of entry. And the city beyond is also sacred because processions go out into that city and return back. And so there are degrees of the sacred. And that, I think, one can apply even to music, that some music is the most sacred music. I would say chant. But polyphony, insofar as it's an amplification of chant, that it also participates in the sacredness of the of the chant, and other kinds of sacred music. I sometimes have come to the defense of the Mozart masses. Some people say, oh, that's just using secular operatic music. You don't have operas in Latin, and you don't have operas that that are principally choral music, that is written in, or that at least includes, a polyphonic style, the style of imitation. The stile ecclesiastico is a fundamental part of the Mozart Mass, and it's a hallmark of the sacred. And you don't have, as I said, you don't have operas in Latin. So there are a number of things that distinguish the Mozart Mass as sacred from just the secular. It's probably not quite as sacred as classical polyphony or as Gregorian chant, but it's like this area in the church instead of that one. It's still sacred. It still leads to God. So that's an important thing about the architecture. If you think about the other arts, the art of making garments, think about the chasuble. The chasuble was an outer Roman garment, like an overcoat. And the priest probably wore it when he celebrated Mass to begin with. But then it went out of fashion as an outer garment. The priest kept wearing it. And pretty soon, people began to receive it as a sacred garment. And then they decided that, I'm making this all up, but they decided that it had to be made of precious material. And then they put sacred symbols on it. And this is all true of vestments now. By tradition, at least, a vestment should be made of silk, a precious material, and have crosses or other sacred symbols that make it unmistakable that this is a sacred garment. Or think about our new translation, where the old translation said for the container for the blood of Christ, a cup. And now it says a chalice. This is one of the parts of that new translation that I found hardest to get used to, because I was so used to hearing, and then he took the cup. And yet when I reflect upon it, a chalice is something very different from a cup. A chalice has become a sacred vessel. It is now made of precious material, and it is adorned with sacred symbols. And it then is more suitable to hold the blood of Christ. So all of those things then contrive to make a composite of the arts. And what that means is every one of those arts should be practiced as perfectly as it can be. We should not compromise for any other reason than necessity to the beauty of the things for the liturgy. But then, let's think about beauty. What is beauty? From the scholastics, we have two different definitions of beauty. One is from St. Albert the Great, splendor formae, the showing forth of the essence of a thing. You have elements that make it clear what the purpose of something is and what its essence is. And it makes this essence palpable and tangible, and it makes it beautiful for us to see. But the other definition is from Thomas Aquinas, and it's a surprising one. Quod visu placet, that which is seen, pleases. One might think this is a kind of a subjectivism. And I've always wondered, wait a minute, why would St. Thomas say something as almost relativistic as that? But you go and read what he says, and it's very interesting. He's talking about the faculties, the intellect and the will. And he says that the object of the will is the good. And you have appetites which cause you to seek the good and to possess the good. The intellect includes that faculty which perceives the beautiful. And the perception of the beautiful is what causes pleasure. So it is a cognitive exercise to perceive the beautiful, which cognitive exercise is at the same time pure pleasure. That is something then that is really valuable to think about, because when you think about splendor formae, you think about the whole context of the liturgy, and you see that, as I told you in the first lecture that I gave, how the various parts of the liturgy contrive to add up to a comprehensive whole. That is the splendor formae of the liturgy, and it's the music which is the splendor formae of the liturgy in particular. That is to say, it is the music which differentiates the parts of the liturgy more than anything else, and which makes them palpable, pleasurable, makes the perception of them a pleasure. Well, then the question is, where does the pleasure of music exist? And I think the fundamental issue is harmony. It's not just chords, and it's not just the making of a bass line over which you realize the harmonies, but it's also the harmonious relationship of the notes within a melody. So the notion of harmony was elaborated by the Greeks, who had only essentially a single melody. And they studied the harmonious relationship between the notes within a melody. But you can speak about the parts of a poem as being harmonious, the parts of a painting as being harmonious. You can speak of the elements of society as being harmonious. You can speak of the weather as being harmonious. You can speak of the seasons. Even the courses of a meal can be harmonious. Think about choosing the wrong first course and having it conflict with the next course. Mistake. The things should be harmonious. And so there is an element of harmony in practically everything that we can witness, or there's potentially an element of harmony. Not all elements of society are harmonious. All you have to do is turn on the news these days. But you see, there's also a higher element of harmony. That is to say, There is the entire order of creation. God built creation in a harmonious order. The Middle Ages thought that the earth was the center, or some of them at least thought that the earth was the center of the planets, and that the harmonious order was a fairly little one. But even with all of our scientific discoveries, there is a sense that there is an order to it. Whether it's the coming and going of stars and planets, or whether it's the next smallest element of the atom, they keep discovering yet a smaller element of the atom. And it's all orderly. So that there is order in all of our personal experiences and in all of the things that we deal with. And when you think about what mathematics is, and I'm no mathematician, and so I'm just making a kind of general observation, but this is a point that Jacques Maritain has talked about. He says mathematics is the second degree of abstraction. You abstract the aspect of number from everything else, and you deal with number, which then, in fact, still relates to everything around you. Music abstracts the element of order and purpose. Music represents orderly motion and purposeful motion that has an analogy to practically every other kind of harmony that we can experience. The social harmony, the harmonies in the courses of a meal, the harmonies in the parts of a symphony. And so what is valuable is that for whatever experience you bring to it, music proposes abstract qualities of purpose and order. And that means that it can, in fact, be the orientation of the liturgy itself. It can be the means by which the liturgy is presented, by means of which the liturgy is comprehended. There is, from classical antiquity, a notion of music that relates to that. Boethius described three kinds of music: sounding music, the music of the soul, and the music of the heavens. That is to say, musica universalis, musica humana, musica instrumentalis. The musica universalis is the harmonious order of the motions of the heavens. The order, in other words, of creation. That is the model for other kinds of order in music. Musica humana is the internal motions of the soul. One can experience a disorder in the motion of the souls, and one can experience an ordering of the motions of the soul. And this notion of musica humana is one that can be modeled upon the abstract notion of order itself, as proposed in the concrete by beautiful music. In other words, the purpose of music, one of the highest purposes of music, is to propose to the soul an orderly motion that the soul can imitate. And so Plato gave us a statement about music and order. And this is in the Timaeus, where he's presenting a kind of hypothetical genesis, how the world might have been created and what purposes it might have served. He says, so much of music as is adapted to the sound of the voice and to the sense of hearing, meaning there's other kinds of music, is granted to us for the sake of harmony. And harmony, which has motions akin to the revolutions of our souls, is not given with a view to irrational pleasure, which is deemed to be the purpose of it in our day, but is meant to correct any discord which may have arisen in the courses of the soul, and to be our ally in bringing her into harmony and agreement with herself. And rhythm, too, was given for the same reason, on account of the irregular and graceless ways which prevail among mankind generally, and to help us against them. I suggest that when we hear a beautiful piece of music, we internalize that music. We take it in and make it our own, and it becomes the model for our own inner life. It becomes the model for the revolutions of our souls. And the hearing of music can, in fact, order our own inner life, and particularly the hearing of music in the liturgy. The music of the liturgy, then, has a fundamentally important element for the soul and for the perception of the liturgy itself. And this is partly because of what I just said, that it is an abstraction of elements of order and purpose that bear a relationship to everything we understand and see and hear. And so we have from Pope Benedict a statement about the relationship of music and the cosmos. The cosmos now is that big reality which includes galaxies whose light hasn't gotten here yet, even. So it's absolutely enormous. But he says, the church must arouse the voice of the cosmos, and by glorifying the Creator, elicit the glory of the cosmos itself, making it also glorious, beautiful, habitable, and beloved. So that the whole notion of heavenly order we must be able now to inhabit it, and we must be able to love it. And I suggest that where we do that is in the liturgy. That's it. Thanks. If you have any questions, I mean, our time is running short, but maybe you have one or two questions. Yes. Very early on in liturgical manuscripts, it says the priest enters into the canon. This suggests that it might be something like an icon screen in the Eastern Church, or it might be that he simply enters into the silence of the canon. That means that this is an unmistakably holy part liturgy. And I like to use what I call the magic flute effect. In the magic flute, you have lots of things going on, but at some point he has to undergo a trial has to walk through fire. And there is this great buildup of energy and tension when he has to walk through fire. And then when he does it, you might imagine that the music would be all that much more tumultuous active. Instead, there's a simple flute melody played that summarizes the intensity of the moment better than all of the tumultuous music might have done. And I think the silence of the canon can be that also. Silence cannot represent the sacred unless there is some kind of frame that makes it unambiguous what's going on. On the other hand, I think the way in which the canon is so often said mistakes the fact that particularly the canon, but that the principal purpose of the liturgy is not instruction. It's not the conveyance of information. Rather, particularly the canon, when the canon is delivered in a kind of a conversational tone of voice and addressed to the congregation, they're looked in the eye even, saying words that are addressed to the Father, there's a disconnect. And the connect has to be that it has to be done as something ultimately sacred. The singing of that canon may help that. And there's some suggestion in the tones of the preface and the Lord's Prayer that there might have been a continuation of that tone for the entire canon historically at one point. No evidence for that one way or the other except for this potential continuity. The issue, however, is with the spoken canon, it's possible that it can become too routine. And one can become inured of the way in which it's being delivered. And that's not going to be so much the case with the silent canon, or even with the sung canon. I have insisted that the priests who celebrate our Mass sing the canon. One of them does not, but he says it in a subdued voice that recalls the silence of the canon, and he does it very well. When I first began to take over the choir after I had been as a graduate student director of this choir, and then I graduated and went off and taught somewhere else, and someone else took it over. Then I came back to Stanford, and at one point they asked me to take the choir back again. At that point, the priest wasn't singing anything. It was a low mass with a congregation and a choir singing the Latin parts of the high mass. Didn't work. I said, no, I'm not going to do that. And they said, well, what would get you to do it? Would you write up for us a description of what would persuade you to take it? I was amazed at doing that, but in any case, I did it. And I specified the singing of all the parts, including the lessons. I thought I could not ask them to sing it. They wouldn't agree to sing it. So I just didn't mention that. And so they agreed, and we began to do a real sung mass, and they spoke the canon. After about 2 months, both of the priests who were celebrating that mass began to sing the canon. It made perfect sense, and still does.